brought a couple of those pieces of paper back today. Ethical dilemmas, you know, that modern businessmen face. You're suggesting ethical dilemmas. Take a couple of these to, again, make the point I was trying to make last night. Somebody wrote, how much to reveal about the product when selling? Just the positive factors or also the poor quality of the product? Now that's an ethical dilemma, and I would agree it is. A man who is ethical is going to wonder and worry about that. But what principle can he use? What ethical principle can he apply so that he knows how much to reveal about the product he's selling? Can anybody suggest an ethical principle that will solve that problem for him?
Well, you can go back to your yesterday's lesson, do unto others. If you're buying a used car, for example, and you want to know what the real mileage is, if you're selling, you'd like to know.
All right.
I don't imagine there's any one product that is perfect in any respect. I think it'd be very difficult if we were trying to claim all the bad qualities about any product that we can make. Very, very difficult.
Suppose that you're a little bad on working on mowers. I mean, you're relatively weak. You're much better on the incisors. When people come here, are you going to tell them? I want you to know all about me. I flunked my course in the but you can go on forever and ever. You can reveal everything about the product. That's something like mileage on used car. I think most people would agree that a guy who, a dealer who turns back for the number, we disapprove of that. There's something just flagrantly and deliberately dishonest about that. But so often, dishonesty is a matter of what you just don't bother mentioning, not what you deliberately tell an untruth about. I don't think you can find any kind of principle, again, that will guide the businessman through this situation. He's going to have to fight it out, and this is really the point. He's going to have to wrestle it out, every situation out of himself somehow.
Well, that's what I think that if you're selling a product, you know if you're in business, you're going to have to stand behind it anyway. So you don't have to point out, maybe not every item is going to be a poor item, but if it does, you'll stand behind it for a year, 6 months, whatever your guarantee is. And that's the reason it might.
Yeah, well, and that's one way we solve that problem.
Right.
So they don't tell you everything about the product, but they guarantee that for a year they'll fix it.
Sure. And you buy on those conditions.
And in that way, we just let business practice get us off the ethical hook. And maybe the guy doesn't have to worry so much about it. Well, I don't know whether it's any good or not, really, but I'll fix it for you. False advertising, that's another example. False advertising. What is false advertising? Justice Brandon, many years ago, rendered an important decision in which a firm was accused of false advertising by the FTC, and the Supreme Court let the firm off the hook. And Brandeis claims that a certain amount of puffing has always been an accepted part of the American tradition, going back to the days of the Yankee peddler. One person I heard argue that actually this was a game that Americans played before they had television. The peddler came to town, everybody knew he was a crook. A nice crook, you know. And he was going to try to get too much, and you play this little game. And that's sort of like they do, I guess, in Oriental bazaar. I'm told if you accept the price that the merchant asks for the flying carpet or whatever he's trying to peddle you in Baghdad, that he's hurt, just spoiled his game. Brandeis was arguing this decision that this is carried through, and that Americans expect an advertiser to play it on a little thick. What has become false? Whether an advertiser says, for example, that Tide will get your clothes 3 times whiter. Is that false advertising? 3 times whiter than what? Or somebody said, when the merchant has to make a decision regarding serving one group at cost of possibly losing the business of another larger group, I think that refers to civil rights.
Okay.
Yeah. That is so easy. That is not so easy. Suppose, look, you're in business in a community where it is taken for granted that Negroes and whites don't associate with one another. Just don't do it. God is the original segregationist. And I think we ought to be very, very careful about it. We can deplore the view that God is a segregationist. I think we have to admit the possibility that some people really can be. After all, most people believe it's the most essential. And we know more. One of the things we know more is the result of anthropological study that proves that the differences of skin color are not as important as men have always believed. Abraham Lincoln thought that there were natural inherent differences between the races that could make it impossible for them ever really to live together. So did George Washington Cable. So did many of the abolitionists. They just were full of slavery. But everybody knew the Negroes were inferior. What did the guy do, let's say, in Texas, before the Civil Rights Laws? Negro wants to get served. Suppose he would like to serve the Negro. But if he does serve the Negro, no white people are going to come to his restaurant. Maybe it's a kind of a high-class restaurant so that most Negroes wouldn't, wouldn't make up for it. They don't have enough income to come and treat the Negro. Does he serve the Negro and wipe himself out, go bankrupt, ruin his business? Does he? Some people would say, of course he does. That's the sacrifice that he makes for the sake of principle. Who's he sacrificing? Maybe he's sacrificing his family? What does he do with his property? Some people say, well, you can't put profits ahead of people. But it's never that simple. Profits and people are in conflict. Profits are used by people. They're used for people. It just ain't simple. What's the principle that a man uses? It's tough. Some people raise some very broad and sweeping questions. One here, how to use men as means to end or ends in themselves? Does the end justify the means? That's one of the biggest questions. Of course, the end always justifies the means. If the end doesn't justify the means, what does? The real question is, the thing is, when you're finished using certain means, you have not only the end, but also the fact that you used the means. And I think if we look at it this way and we get over this little dilemma here, certainly the end justifies the means, if in fact the end justifies the means. But how do you know when it does? And there's no principle, I think, to answer the means.
Well, when does the end justify itself?
Well, that's part of the problem. Is the end really worthwhile? See, what you've got here, here's an end that you want. In order to get there, you got to take this route. Here's where you are now. To get here is good, but how about taking that route? Is that good too? And you say, no, that's not too good. Not good to take that route. But when you get here, you will have a good being here and an ungood having taken this route. And you put it all together, that's what you have to do. You put it all together and you decide whether you should do it. And that's the way life is. We never make it. It is almost impossible to make a purely good decision when you consider simply the consequences. Almost in every act of creation, there is an act of destruction. Life is death. What kind of way you put it? We like to suppose that when we get the, for example, when we have written out a $25 check to the Red Cross, we have done a purely good thing, but we haven't. We have not written out a $25 check to the NAACP. We've taken $25, given it to the Red Cross, but it might have been used for some other good purpose. Might have done even more good. I'm not trying to make you scrupulous and keep you contributing to the Red Cross, but you also can't suppose that there are simple principles that will enable you always to make the right decision in any situation. Well, I want to take an example out of it. There's a very important article written a number of years ago, not 2 years ago, 1961, in the Harvard Business Review by a man named Raymond Baumhart, who is now the Dean of the College of Business Administration at Loyola of Chicago. He's an S.J., and he was working on his doctoral dissertation at the time at Harvard. And the article is called How Ethical Are Businessmen? And it is regarded as a classic in the field. And I think it's pretty good article because it points out all of the mistakes that people drift into in talking about ethics. Maybe Baumhart makes all those mistakes. I mean, we're running a waging war with this article for several years. I've never met Mr. Baumhart, and one of these days I'm afraid I'm going to meet him even hopefully. But I think he's a good example of the error into which Roman Catholics can drift in discussing business ethics because of their legalistic tradition. They have the notion that there are principles, there's got to be principles, their tradition of casuistry. And the Baumhart is looking for what he calls medial norms. He admits, what I was saying yesterday, that you can have very, very lofty principles that everybody will accept, but then they don't mean anything. You can't get them down to cases. And he will admit, too, that if you get down to cases, then the norms don't, you try to come up with rules for every situation, you're going to have so many rules. You're going to spend all your time discussing rules, that won't work either. So he talks about medial norms, and he's convinced there are some. It's interesting that in a long, long article, he never lists one. There are some, but he never writes. Well, he comes up with a couple of statements here. Toward the end of the article, he says, what is the future? And then he gives some heartening examples of courageous decisions made for ethical reasons. And one of them is this. The president of a company engaged in mass communication faced the choice of giving up a valued client of long-standing and great profitability and having to resort to laying off hard to replace employees, or yielding to the client's demand to do something I didn't believe in. I chose the former course. A Baumhart clause. I want this guy to hear his choice. Do something he didn't believe in, or give up a client, valued client, long-standing, and have to lay off a bunch of employees. He gave up the client, laid off his employees, Baumhart pats him on the back and says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Was that clearly an ethical decision? Was that the right decision to make? You see, he doesn't say what this thing was he didn't believe in. But this guy did something bad. He laid off a bunch of employees. Is that good? As these dozen employees of long standing and hard to replace went home to their wives and said, I'm laid off. Was that good? Very often, businessmen will make decisions on the basis of something they believe in and hang the consequences. And all sorts of people will suffer for their principles. You ever known people like that? Who will say, I am going to do what I believe in. I don't care who dies for it. And of course, it won't be me. I cannot believe that that's a purely ethical decision. That's not necessarily right. This is true throughout this article. Whenever he comes up with something that he really applauds, something a businessman did that was just crystal clear. Let me take one more example. Whenever he finds one of these cases, and he lists it, he goes, wasn't that good, that proves businessmen are ethical. In every case, I've got doubts. I'm not sure the guy made the right decision. Another one here, the sales manager refused to give a payoff required to secure distribution of a consumer product in a grocery chain. He says, I have been tempted, but have not gone along with it under the counter dealing. Our sales are hurt as a result. Hurrah for him, says Bob Martin. That's a nuts. He should never have done that. The sales manager, look, suppose it's a grocery chain. If somebody in a grocery chain is requiring a payoff to secure distribution of your product, you've got an obligation to snitch on it. It's not just to refuse to pay off a chain. There's some hanky-panky going on here. You're silly if you let your sales be hurt. Look, all you'd have to do is go to this guy's superior and say, if you notice that our product isn't being carried in your stores, yeah, I wouldn't know that. Do you know that your purchasing agent wants a bribe? There's something fishy in this whole thing, I suspect. Very, very frequently, in fact, sales managers, when they can't push their product, will claim that it's because they got to pay bribes. And in fact, the product isn't any good, and the salesmen are out there hustling. I think this sales manager did quite the wrong thing. Either the situation is not as he described it, or he did not fully accept his responsibility to alter the situation which he found. I think any salesman who finds that he's got to pay bribe in order to sell his product has an obligation to try to do something about He can't just retreat and say, okay, so I won't sell. Because what he's doing then is turning the world over to the bribers. Nothing simple. Nothing simple. Well, now, the impression that I think I've been giving some people is that there ain't no evidence. There's no difference between right and wrong. That is not the impression I mean to give. I do mean to give the impression that it is never simple to tell the difference between right and wrong in a concrete situation. That there are no 10 commandments or 20 commandments or 100 commandments that you can consult and unfailingly, unerringly determine the right course of action in any situation. You never know for sure that what you are doing is right. You always take a risk. But when you take a risk, you do so in the hope that you're right. And what are you consulting to determine the right? I submit that it is not principles. You're consulting something else. The source, the norm of the good. Ethics deals with the good, with human conduct, which we want to be good. But what do we mean by good? What determines whether something is good or not? There are a number of answers that people have given to this question, types of answers. Let me list some. Some people believe that the good is determined by what has been called divinely dictated precepts. That's one popular answer. Other people would say that, this is close to it, the good is determined by God or the moral lawgiver. And their sons and everything all merged into each other, determined by some realm of essences. And then it's known by natural reason. I'll just use this. They're very good if you can break these things down. I think this is the view that most Christians take. Well, before thinking about it. Is the difference between right and wrong? Do I know the difference between right and wrong? Well, consult the commandments. I know that there are more commandments than the Ten Commandments. Got to look at the New Testament, too, and take a look at the Sermon on the Mount and all the other things and things St. Paul says. Like, we wouldn't know without St. Paul that women are not allowed to vote in the church. Now, the trouble with claiming that we know the difference between right and wrong from divinely dictated precepts is that there aren't enough precepts. But where in the Bible do you get the rule on whether you should purchase stock on the basis of insider information? It's in there. You've always got to go beyond the precepts. The other problem is, of course, that the precepts are valid only for members of the cult. And as we well know, people have the habit of interpreting the precepts in the Bible quite differently. And if the good is, well, look, is the good arbitrary? I mean, is what we should do just something that God made up to sort of put us through the paces, like a hop, skip, and jump? There's a certain rule. Now, why can't you jump, hop, and skip? Well, it's not the way it's done. Why are the in softball, you're not allowed to leave the base before the ball is pitched. Why? Well, that's arbitrary, isn't it? But suppose somebody says, but I want to. I like to get off the base. Well, oh, you see, that's not the rule. That's not the rule. Now, that's what God did. God created man, and he said, well, I don't want to have it too easy, so I'll make a rule. And he just said, here, whole batch of rules. Or are the things we're supposed to do, are the things we're not supposed to do, let's say, is sin something in the nature of things or a violation of the nature of things, or is sin just a violation of a bunch of arbitrary commands of God? I cannot accept the latter view. I do not think that God is arbitrary or capricious or playing a game with us. Sin is a violation of the order of things. Sin is a refusal or an inability to be what God has made us and to live in accord with his whole creation. The good is living in accord with reality, a reality which we know to be a divine reality. Now, if you accept this view of the good, then you've got to be uneasy with the notion that we know the good through listening to a bunch of commandments that are arbitrarily laid down, because we know that what is good for one is good for another. That the good is not, one cult can't say this is good, another cult says that is good. While it's true that we may have different emphases, ultimately the good is one. So this is a very, I think, very uneasy and unsatisfactory position. If you try to get beyond it, you say, well, get away from the precepts, let's just consult God himself, the supreme architect of the universe and the moral lawgiver. The trouble with that is, we all know it's the epistemological problem here. You can agree, everybody could agree that God is the moral lawgiver, but nobody knows what he says. What law did he give? And you also have the problem of what then are ethics for the agnostic? When you get down into here, these are the positions of perennial philosophy. Both of these are stating that there is something, somewhere, which can be consulted in a non-arbitrary way, and the good thereby discerned. Now, against this, these views, which I think basically Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, even Luther, when he was being systematic and not shoot from the hip, which all these men held, against this, the standard objection is that, well, the history shows that men cannot agree on the nature of the good. What's the use, for example, of affirming a natural law binding upon everybody when most men say they don't know that? No, what is the natural? They disagree on what they think birth control. This is a classic example. A lot of times, the Catholics on this question. And the natural law forbids all artificial methods of birth control. And because it is the natural law, it's binding upon all men, even Lutherans. Though we live in a state of invincible ignorance. But I can't see it. And the natural law is supposed to be something that you don't need revelation to know. You should be just able to consult the nature of things, look carefully and honestly, and see that it's wrong to use artificial methods of ritual. Or someone, I heard a Roman Catholic layman once asked, well, what is more artificial than the rhythm method? Which is a good question. What do we do? What do you use the feeling of natural law when one guy's natural law and the other guy's natural law? And so what we are driven, I think, toward an interesting and most uncomfortable intellectual position. When it comes to ethics, the thinking man is an absolutist in theory, because we will not admit that the good is merely a matter of subjective preference. Maybe I better stress this. Some people will say, they'll say, well, you say, what's the good? You say, well, it depends on what you believe. What should a man do? Depends on what he wants. But we don't really accept that. I had a Jewish student last semester at the State University, which I was teaching one day a week, who took this position. And I said, you mean, ultimately, there is no difference between right and wrong. Not ultimately, no, there isn't. That it's a matter of, he said, but it isn't just a matter of what the individual believes, it's a matter of what the whole society believes too. The good is a matter of living in conformity with the mores of society. Well, you know what I pushed him on. And before you knew it, he was insisting that regardless, if the whole world had been Nazis and wanted to kill Jews, it would have been wrong. And he's right. If everybody in the world thought it was a good thing to kill Jews, it would still be wrong to kill Jews. I know it. Which suggests that, unless I'm deluded, I think unless you are all deluded too, the good is something more than what we want, more than our personal preference. So that, and as soon as you say this, you're asserting that the good is something absolute. The good is something independent of what you prefer. But the trouble is, now as soon as you try to get down to what the good is, you become a relativist in every aspect of practice, because we're unable to define this absolute good, or to affirm anything except a relative good. We say the good is beyond our control. It's something that judges us, not something which we determine. But every time we get into a situation, we can't seem to come up with any clear-cut definition of what the good is. And we always smell like relativists while we're talking like absolutists. Is there a way out? I think that there is. And now, If you don't understand what I'm talking about, I ask you to believe that I do. And for those who we went on with where this comes, I will confess. Maybe I'm not confessing. I'm just going to walk. I'm just going to talk slowly and see if, when I'm all through, you have an inkling of what I'm talking about. I said that the good is not arbitrary, but the good is determined by the nature of things. It would have to be so because God is the author of things. Right? Now, everything that is, every being, participates in the power to be. Otherwise, it couldn't be. Justice, which is the key concept in ethics, is the measure of what is due to every being. This is what we mean by justice. Justice is what is due to a person, or even to a thing. There's justice to a thing. You don't do certain things to trees. You don't carve your initials in them. I don't like a bit unjust, but what anything, let's focus on people, what anyone is due, what is due to a person, the standard of justice is determined by this person's power of being. This would be true for collectives, for societies, as well as for individuals. The power of being, of every being, must be respected. This is what justice demands. It would be unjust, notice, to accord the same to a child and to an adult. That would be unjust. To give to a child what is due to an adult would be unjust. To concede to a weak nation as much as you feel is due to a strong nation would be unjust, because they have different powers of being. We Americans ought to remember that. We sometimes get guilty consciences about the fact that we throw more weight around in the world than Afghanistan. We've got more power of being, therefore we have more responsibility, therefore more is due to us. But something is due to Afghanistan too. A highly competent person is owed more than a less competent person. A normal man has more due to him than a psychotic. A productive person, because he has more power of being, is owed more than an unproductive. Thus, what is owed to one, what is just, is not arbitrary. But of course, it's less than perfectly unambiguous. Nobody goes around with his quotient of power of being on it so that you can consult it and decide what he gets. But now, the real ethical problems arise when these beings or centers of power come into conflict. When the power of one being can only be enhanced at the expense of another. Is there a judging principle in such cases beyond that of mere justice? Here, one person, because of his power, is due a certain thing, but he can only secure it at the expense, apparently, of what seems to be due to another. What is the criterion that judges in cases like this? Is there something now beyond justice? And I would say yes. And that is being itself. Being is, you think about it, now you got to get abstract. You got to get beyond every particular thing that is and think of what everything that is has in common. Everything has this in common, that it bees. It is. It does not be. It participates in being. Being, the ground of being, is that in which everything participates. And being is finally a unity, within which specific beings are diversity. If being were undifferentiated, this would be death. It would be void, chaos, nothing. Would be uncreated. being actualizes itself in beings, thus in separation, in differentiation within being. In the act of creation, God created conflict. But now, though being differentiates itself into being, no being is separate from the ground of being, which of course is God. And God, the process of creation, the continual ongoing process of what we call creation and preservation, is somehow the process of God separating us off from the ground and the power in which we nonetheless live and move and have our being. But we are not God. I'm not a pantheist anyhow. I'm not God. And yet I am grounded in God all the time, as is every other thing that exists. Now, things come into conflict, but they always have this unity of ground. And God is constantly in the process of creation and preservation, attempting to maintain the separation within being and yet overcome it. To put it in other words, to preserve your identity and yet overcome your rebellion against God. Not to slug you and drag you back, to let you be an individual and yet overcome your separation from being. Preserve your separation so that you are you, an individual, a being within being, and yet at the same time restore you to the ground of your being. And this act, this overcoming of separation within being, is love. When we say that God is love, what we are saying is that God is the power of being overcoming separation within being, that God is the ground, the power of being itself. Now, love is finally the judgment upon justice. But let's try this out. The trouble is, people, you see, have sentimentalized love very much. We've got the idea that love is feeling, love is emotion. This obviously doesn't work. Because we can say a mother loved her child to death, or we can say you can suffocate a person with too much love. And here we're saying that love is not really love. It's feeling, it's enough. Love is more than feeling. It's feelings, you know, icky feelings, or sentimental feelings, or I like you. This is judged in some way by the principle of love itself. Now, you can get at it by thinking of the types of love there are. For example, I can say, I love Rembrandt. What kind of love is it? This is love for something which is true and good. There is I love Rembrandt. Now, Rembrandt painted me. I am attracted toward it. That's why I love it. It pulls me. Many forms of love are like this. This is pretty close to what the Greek meant by eros. Unfortunately, we use the term erotic love to mean the kind of thing that Playboy does. Erotic means dirty, almost, in our world. It doesn't. Erotic love is the love of attraction. And it doesn't have to be sexual at all. Although sexual is one of the four. You see a beautiful girl, and you should have eros toward her. You know, that wrote it. But there are other kinds. There's the friendship or love of friends. It's a matter of mutual attraction. See, the Rembrandt painting is not at all attractive to me. But friends are attracted to one another. Love for the other for the sake of self. I meet people whom I love because I become more in the process of loving them, and I want them to return that love so that I become more. And this is good. And I think this gets pretty close to the Greek philia, which is another Greek word for love. And we only have one word for it. The mutuality of love. But what about the other kind of love, love of enemies? Clearly this can't be any kind of attraction at all. What do we mean when we talk about the love of enemies? Is this will overcoming repulsion? I mean, if it's really your enemy, you hate him. Otherwise, he wouldn't be your enemy. If you love him, he's not your enemy, right? You don't like him. He's a fake. But you're supposed to love him. What is this love? Hey, here, you reflect on that? How can you love your enemy? As soon as you love them, they cease to be your enemy. Well, not so. They can continue to be your enemy, and you can still love them. But what is this kind of love? I think there's a key. I'm not relying on psychology again, but psychiatry can frequently illuminate something for us. Modern psychiatry speaks of the sense of not being loved as the root of neurosis and psychosis. The implication is that love is power. The love of a mother for her child at 2 weeks is power. It is forming, creating, shaping that child. The love of a pastor for a member of his congregation who is deeply troubled can be power. It is power. The love that we have for one another is frequently power. It overcomes estrangement. It overcomes separation. Psychotic is estranged. He's cut off. He's alienated. His roots have come up. He's no place. He's Napoleon. That's crazy. It's crazy because he's gotten loose from the ground of his being. And by love, we know that we can restore a person to the ground of being. We can enable him to participate in his inherent power to be. Love, then, is the power of being overcoming separation. And that's far more than emotion or feeling. And that is pretty close to what the Greek means by agape, which is the word that the New Testament uses for love. So you see how it's possible to love your enemy? He's still your enemy. He's out to get you. You've got to watch him. He'll slit your throat. You frequently have to do him dirt. And how can you love him? You love him because all the time you are attempting to overcome the separation between you and him while you are shooting at it. I'm sure it's not practical. But it's a back there, a compulsion that's driving us all the time. While you are trying to shoot him in war, put him in jail, fight him off, punish him, you are still striving to overcome the separation. I want my kids this morning. And I think the parent knows that. That's the sense of the statement, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. You've got to spank the little buggers. You've got to punish them. And this is serious. It's not a game to play. And yet, you are striving to overcome the separation between you and them, the separation between themselves and what really is. The separation between themselves and God. My kids were fairly separated from God this morning. Mm-hmm. As proved by the fact they were clocking each other. You hear? Now, in Christian language, the power of being, which I'm talking about, being itself is God. You can use a lot of other terms to describe God, too. They're all symbolic. They're all metaphoric. When we say God is our Father, well, not really. When you say God is a spirit, that's nice, but have you ever seen a spirit? What do you mean by that? All of these are the limping symbols that we use to try to express the meaning of God. But we can also say, and I think this is more true than almost anything else we would say, that God is the power of being. God is being itself. Thus, God, who is love, is finally the principle of justice. But justice, in this sense, becomes creative justice. Justice, I said, is what one is due. Justice is always a matter of proportioning things to an individual's power of being. But creative justice, justice informed and judged by love, records more than is due to that power of being, so that the power of being may be enhanced. Now, let me get down out of the clouds of obscurity. I've got 10 minutes to try to see whether all of this says anything at all for our problem, which is, remember, way back when, is there such a thing as Christian business ethics? What I have been saying is that the good, I mean, what I've been saying the last few minutes, the good is not arbitrary, because the good is grounded in God, in being itself. Secondly, I've been saying that the good varies with each situation, because each situation is unique. And justice requires a unique response to a unique situation. Justice requires that you give everyone what is due, what is in proportion to his power of being. And for everyone, this is different. Thirdly, I'm saying that the good is not static. I'm saying that good overcomes evil. There is a creative principle in good that takes account not only of what is, but of what might be, of potentiality as well as actuality. Now we come to a businessman who's sitting there shaking and saying, I want to make a good decision. I want to make an ethical decision. If he wants to make ethical decisions, he must take account now of the three terms that I've been using: power, justice, and love. These are the crucial concepts for ethics. Now, the cat is out of the bag. Somebody wants to know what I've been talking about, I would suggest that you read Love, Power, and Justice by Paul Tillich. And everything I've been saying is Paul Tillich. I hope he's all right. Tillich is, in my view, the most profound ethical thinker writing today. And he is a Catholic philosopher. He has made sense for me. Some people would say he has misinterpreted for me Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, and Luther, and everybody practically. Tillich has made them make sense, and I feel that in Paul Tillich's philosophical theology, the best of the tradition of Christian philosophy, I mean real philosophy, has been preserved. In fact, I think the best of the whole perennial philosophy has been preserved. And then what I've been saying, though it is the word of language is Tillichian, I feel certain Plato could go along with it. I'm not too sure about Aristotle. Thomas could go along with it. And I think Luther would buy it. But anyway, that makes it tough. If the businessman wants to make an ethical decision, he has to consider the power of being, of the people with whom he deals, and of the situations with which he deals, and the collectives with which he deals. He has to consider, for example, the power of being of his own enterprise. Ever think of that? Businessman says, I'm going to have to make a decision now that will require me to sacrifice the enterprise. We're going down the drain. Maybe justice will not allow him to do that. Something is due to that enterprise. Why should a businessman maximize profits? Because it is his responsibility to the enterprise, which is in his care, which is a going entity, which has being, and by the way, upon which all sorts of people depend. He can't just ditch that thing as if it's his personal possession to be tossed off lightly. A businessman has a responsibility to the enterprise, and to all of the individuals working for the enterprise, and to his suppliers, to his consumers. What responsibility? The responsibility to give to each of them what is due. You say, what's due? What is due to them has to be proportioned to their power of being. Now, what's their power of being? You gotta look to find out. You gotta look. And that's why making ethical decisions is a hard, hard task. You gotta know something about the situation. You gotta know the people with whom you're working. If you want to be just to your friend, you've got to know your friend. It isn't enough just to say, I love you, and then follow them up because you don't know their situation. And we do that, don't we? Sometimes because of our impatience, we don't want to listen long enough to find out what this person really is. We want to solve the problem for them. And yesterday, somebody commented on me. They had the impression that I was reducing Christian ethics to just arbitrary personal preferences. Since there weren't no principles, anybody can do whatever he wants to. And that's terrible. But it turns out, what I'm really trying to do is just get away from arbitrariness.